to find ways to teach our children the right way, the right manner.
It's only fair, right?
Because it's, we want no, them it's to not just fair. It's actually their right. So, for example, if you read Risalat al-Huquq for Imam Sajjad Salamullah alayhi, when he talks about the right of the child, for example, he says, one of the, to begin with, you have to choose a good mother for it. That's his right. This is not an option.
Even before he's born, you got to find a good mother.
Exactly. And then once he's born, you need to choose a right name for him. And once you choose a right name for him, then you have to teach him. And how do you do these things if you yourself lack? As we say, you know, the famous quote, you cannot give what you lack yourself. Exactly. So if you're lacking this information, how would you give it to your kids? And sometimes even the basics, I've seen some people, like when they want to name their kids, they open a book, for example, and they just choose a random word. Or some people, I know some religious people, when they want to choose the name of their kids, they open the Quran and the first letter or the first word, word on the right page is the name of their child.
Right.
which is devastating.
Dear Sayyid, our time for today's program is unfortunately up. We will, however, continue our discussion, inshallah, in the next program. Dear listeners, thank you for joining us on the program. This has been your host, Musa Al-Bahadili, coming to you from your program, Islamic Upbringing, broadcasting to you from IRB English Radio. Dear listeners, if you have any questions, comments, or just some feedback, please contact us at our email, englishradio@irb.ir. You can alternatively also visit our website, parstoday.com. And until another program, fi amanillah and God bless you all.
Do you know what Islam says? It says that life's the greatest test. It says that life's a borrowed space, returned upon rest. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way. Islam solves all of our problems. Allah leaves no stone unturned. Perfect with no flaws at all are the laws of Allah. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way.
Aperture.
Throughout its history, Iran was never a colony of Britain, or indeed a colony of anyone. Yet it has suffered much self-interested interference by Britain. Now, decades after MI6 engineered a coup against Iran's democratically elected prime minister to safeguard the UK's oil interests in Iran, the relations between the two countries is still fraught with mistrust. I'm Zarin Shajari, and this is Aperture. Iran and the UK have historically had a very turbulent relationship. And not surprisingly, the Iranian mindset is still highly suspicious of Britain, considering the huge historical and psychological pressure of the damage Britain inflicted on Iranian independence and interest. This prolonged pattern of British anti-Iranian policies have continued to recent years and linger vividly in the hearts and minds of Iranians. Stay with us.
I am Malcolm Byrne, Deputy Director of the National Security Archive, a non-governmental organization based at George Washington University in Washington, D.C. Well, I don't think the coup did fail. There was a moment originally when it faltered, and certain events that were planned on did not unfold as expected. But the CIA operatives in place and their Iranian cohorts did manage to pull off the overthrow of Mossadegh. So I think in that sense, in the short-term sense, the coup absolutely succeeded. I know that there is a lot of suspicion out there about British influence on the United States, especially back in 1953. But my reading of the information of the declassified documents and memoir accounts and so on makes me believe that the picture was much more complicated than that. The Americans and the British were certainly close allies after the war, but that did not mean that they agreed on everything by any means. And the attitude of the British towards the oil nationalization movement was a case in point. Fundamentally, the U.S. disagreed and disapproved of British, what they would have termed neocolonialism. Now, in the end, the two sides came to terms because the United States decided that it had a lot more to gain by siding with Britain in the long run than it did by opposing them and siding with Iran. So they did come to terms, but it was not an easy relationship in that sense, and it certainly was not a matter of the British persuading their junior partner, the United States, to go along. Nothing of the sort. For the most part, the records have not been declassified. A large chunk of them were destroyed over the years by the CIA. They acknowledge this, claiming that it had to do with very mundane office procedures and a lack of office space and so on, which has raised some questions in the outside world. Whatever remains, and it is apparently roughly about one box full of documents, is mostly still classified. They have released certain materials, a couple of the internal histories about the coup written by historians who work for the CIA have been released, and a handful of other materials have been released through the Freedom of Information Act. Now, there is, as we are doing this interview, there is in preparation a volume of the State Department's official history of U.S. foreign policy called the Foreign Relations of the United States series. Well, I think it was both a tactical act and an expression of regret about the coup. I think it fell a little bit short of an outright apology. The State Department was very careful to craft her words, but I do believe it was a genuine expression of acknowledgement that the United States took part in the coup, first of all, and also that it was an expression of some regret that the coup had taken place, in part because of the bad feelings that it generated in Iran over the years. Well, the question of the historical context is a big one, and the political context. The first point to make is that these events in Iran took place during a very difficult period in the Cold War, the rivalry between the Soviet Union and the United States. There have been a number of very distressing events that had taken place in the years leading up to the nationalization crisis, including the Soviet occupation of Azerbaijan in 1945-46, the Soviet takeover of power in Eastern Europe, the coup in Czechoslovakia in 1948, the loss of China, so-called, around that same time, the explosion of the Soviet atomic test. All kinds of events had happened that had built up American concerns about the communist threat worldwide. Iran, for a number of years, had been considered by U.S. strategists as a quote-unquote vital interest of the United States. It was vital because of its geographic location near the Soviet Union, but also, of course, because of its rich oil deposits. Value of petroleum in this case was not so much because of its commercial value, but because of its strategic value. It was seen, and you can read this in many policy papers from the White House and from the analyses from the CIA and elsewhere that have been declassified, that the overriding concern was that oil be made available to the West in order to continue to rebuild their economies after World War II. And even in the event of a global war with the Soviets, which was not a completely ludicrous idea at that point, that oil would be crucial to helping the West fight that battle. By the same token, it was considered extremely important to deny access to oil, and particularly oil in the Persian Gulf, to the Soviets for the same reasons, that it would give them a huge advantage and a disadvantage to the West. One of the most interesting documents that I've seen in doing research on this subject is from the Truman period, where Harry Truman signed an order that allowed for planning to be carried out to demolish oil wells in Saudi Arabia and to otherwise make oil facilities unusable in the event of a Soviet invasion. This was the extent to which they believed that an invasion might be possible and the extent they were willing to go to make sure that the Soviets were not able to take advantage of the oil resources of the region. Well, the actual role of individual players in the coup is a big question. Generally speaking, the way I view the coup is that the Americans played the main role in terms of organizing and planning the coup. Of course, they had considerable help from the British on the planning side of things, but that the Iranians generally played a critical role in the actual implementation of the coup. Americans and Iranians worked together in many ways, and there were many individuals who were involved. There were people who were directly tied to the CIA and to MI6, the so-called Bosco brothers, as they were known, and the Rashidian brothers. The Bosco brothers was a code name for a pair of Iranian individuals who were tied closely to the CIA, named Kevani and Jalali. The Rashidian brothers were well known at the time, and they were closely associated with MI6. Each of those groups had a large number of people who either worked for them, worked with them, or over whom they had some influence. In addition, there were military officers. Of course, there was General Zahedi and his son, and allegedly were involved in some way or another. Whether or not they were completely aware of who they were working with is unknown. There were people involved in the Shah's court at many different levels and in many spheres. Iranians played an important part along with their erstwhile partners from the outside. Well, both were critical, of course, to the planning of the operation. It was a joint planning session, and there are varying reports about who played the lead role at that stage. What I tend to come away with is the notion that the British essentially gracefully took a back seat to the Americans, even though it was the British who had first come to Washington to propose a coup in late 1952, at least a version of the coup that ended up being more or less what they followed through with ultimately. In terms of implementing the coup, it was of course mostly the United States. The British offered some help in terms of providing access to their networks in Iran, but having been expelled from the country in October 1952, there was hardly much of a role for them to play in person in Iran at the time, so that fell largely to American agents. There is some debate about why there was such a distinction between the Truman and Eisenhower administrations. On its face, it appears as though the two presidents had very different ideas about many, many things. But the closer you look at the issue, the more you see that their views converged. They both, for example, felt very strongly about the threat posed by the Soviet Union and international communism to American interests. And they both, particularly as time went on under Truman, probably shared more of a view about the deteriorating situation in Iran. It's certain that at first Truman believed that it was necessary and possible to negotiate a settlement with Mossadegh and the Iranians from 1951-52. In 1952, and especially as the year dragged on, it became more of a question, especially for some of Truman's advisors and officials inside Tehran, for example. But virtually to the end of his administration, it seems pretty clear that even though Truman and Dean Acheson, for example, his Secretary of State, saw that conditions were getting worse and felt the need to prepare for a worst-case scenario, it still seems clear that they both were anxious to try to negotiate a deal rather than to do something drastic like a coup. In fact, they never did agree to a coup. They left it to the incoming Eisenhower administration to make that decision, which, of course, they did not long after entering the White House. I believe that the British did not so much convince the United States as the United States decided that it was the wiser choice for them, the more strategic choice, to go along with the British, that is, to support the British in their attempts to get what they wanted out of the oil crisis. That's a very different thing from saying that they were convinced by the British. Clearly, the British sent some of their officials, their agents, to Washington in late 1952 to put across this idea of carrying out a coup. They did meet with some sympathy from the incoming Eisenhower people, but I don't believe that Eisenhower or his associates needed any convincing. I think they, first of all, did not want to cede that kind of issue to the British. I think they believed that they knew perfectly well how the world worked and what the United States needed to advance its interests. They did not need London to tell them that. What I believe they finally decided was that even though the British were being highly intransigent, and there's plenty of evidence to indicate that this was the U.S. view, they believed that there was much more at stake in the global environment, in fighting the Cold War, and in a variety of other international issues, much more at stake in siding with the British and making sure that their relationship was smooth than there was at stake in siding with Iran on this one particular issue, about which they had a great many qualms to begin with, mainly not just the strategic, but also the commercial. It's easy to get into psychological evaluations in a case like this, and that's a difficult thing to do. But I do believe that what happens in situations like this, and we've seen it in more recent circumstances as well, is that policymakers, like people everywhere, tend to believe what they want to believe. They will often have in mind a particular interpretation of events or a preferred course of action. And I think in possibly too many cases, you will find that they will look for the evidence to support that case. I think the Iran situation was a perfect example of that. There is plenty of evidence in CIA files and in meeting records and so on to indicate that there were serious and knowledgeable individuals who did not believe that the Soviet Union or the Tudeh Party represented a serious threat to Mossadegh or to U.S. interests. There was also evidence that the Iranian economy was not nearly in the dire straits that some believed. And yet, these were among the issues that policymakers in Washington clung to, some of the beliefs that they adhered to in coming to the decision that they had to act. Now, I think it's important to note that it is not that they believed that Mossadegh was anti-U.S. or pro-Soviet. It's true that that his threats or his attempts to make deals with the Soviets here and there did cause a little bit of concern. But I think the main concern, even in the Eisenhower administration, was not so much how Mossadegh felt, but how stable he was and his government was, and what would happen in the event of of his downfall. A classic question that comes up frequently is whether or not, for example, Israel has an overwhelming interest or overwhelming influence over the United States. And I think that is a very complicated question, too. There's no doubt that Washington pays attention to what is going on in Israel and what is going on in the domestic political situation here in the United States as far as the Israel lobby. But if you want to get into particulars, you quickly realize how complex it is. It's not just one Israel lobby, for example. There are many different parts to it. Also, what I have found in looking at more recent events involving the U.S. and Iran, for example, the Iran-Iraq War, but also other events in the Persian Gulf, is that it's not just Israel the U.S. listens to, it's the Arab monarchies. It's Saudi Arabia and the other Gulf states that are very important to American officials as they try to define what their policies are going to be. I think Americans and American officials in particular are prone to thinking in the short term. And if you think in the short term and you're a CIA agent or you're a U.S. government official from 1953, you're very likely to see the coup as having been a success and very much worthwhile. Former CIA officials that I've talked to and others have talked to have made the point that, in their view, the coup was not the problem. It was the follow-up to the coup. And it was specifically the failure of subsequent presidents to hold the Shah's feet to the fire and make sure, as they see it, that the Shah carried through on promises of reform that he had made. Perspective, 25 years is a very long time, but of course we have now had more than 25 years since the Iranian Revolution, and to the extent that you can connect the dots between that revolution and the 1953 coup, you realize that the aftermath in terms of dismal relations between the two countries and all kinds of crises and strife that have ensued, it makes you realize that in the long run, the blowback, as they call it, has certainly been severe.
Is Iran now, in effect, at war with the United States?
What do you mean by war? If you mean our armies against the United States armies, no, there is no such war. If you mean it is a battle of nerves, it is Carter's doing.
Stories from the Past. stories from the lives of the infallibles. Stories from different parts of the world. On the Lantern.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Dear listeners, thank you so very much for joining us on today's episode of The Lantern. As The Lantern tradition, we have a short little story, very interesting, about elephants. About an elephant. I love elephants, by the way. They're so big and beautiful and majestic, and yet so harmless. I know a lot of people get killed by elephants, but then again, it's sort of not the elephant's fault. It's usually our fault for, you know, expanding our infrastructures and trespassing into elephant territory. That's not the point. The point is, please listen to this short anecdote, and we're going to be right back on The Lantern.
In the name of Allah, Salaam Alaikum, dear friend. Welcome to this episode of Lantern. As you know, we have an interesting story at the beginning of each episode. The Blind Man and the Elephant is the title of today's story. Let's listen. A long time ago in India, there lived six men who were all blind since birth. One day, they fell to arguing. The object of their dispute was the elephant. Now, since each was blind, none had ever seen that mighty beast. So to satisfy their minds and settle the dispute, they decided to go and seek out an elephant. Having hired a young guide, they set out early one morning in single file along the forest track, each placing his hands on the back of the man in the front. It was not long before they came to a forest clearing where a huge bull elephant was standing contemplating his menu for the day. The six blind men became quite excited. Thus it was that the men took turns to investigate the elephant's shape and form. "Oh, my brother," the first man at once cried out, "this elephant is like a great mud wall baked hard in the sun." "Now, my brothers," the second man exclaimed, "I can tell you what shape this elephant is. He's exactly like a spear." The others smiled in disbelief. "Why, dear brothers, do you not see?" said the third man. "This elephant is very much like a rope." "Ha, I thought as much," the fourth man declared excitedly. "This elephant much resembles a serpent." "Good gracious, brothers," the fifth man called out, "even a blind man can see what shape the elephant resembles most. Why, he is mightily like a fan." At last, it was the turn of the sixth old fellow, and he proclaimed, "This sturdy pillar, brothers, mine, feels exactly like the trunk of a great Arica palm tree." This curiosity satisfied, they all linked hands and followed the guide back to the village. Once there, seated beneath a waving palm, the six blind men began disputing loud and long. Each now had his own opinion, firmly based on his own experience. For after all, each had felt the elephant for himself and knew that he was right. And so indeed he was. For depending on how the elephant is seen, each blind man was partly right, though all were in the wrong.
The Lantern.
Under the light of lantern, we'll look at the story which indicates a moral aspects of our life.
All right, so maybe the story was more about six blind men than an elephant, but that elephant was involved, and we have to point out the elephant in the room, pun intended, and because I love elephants so much. I think I already said that. The point is, so six blind men go around and wondering about how an elephant looks like. They've never seen what an elephant looks like. So they decide to go check out an elephant, and they check it out the way blind people do, which is a very extraordinary process. It's like their eyes are on the tip of their fingers, and they touch, even because an elephant is huge, obviously, each of them is touching one part of the elephant. One could be touching the trunk, one could be touching the tail, the leg, the skin, the back, the front, the bottom, and they obtain an assessment, each of them, based on the part of the elephant they came in contact with. And they thought to themselves, well, that's how an elephant looks like, right? They applied it to their previous personal experiences, and they connected the dots together, and 2 + 2 equals an elephant looks like a fan. Because probably that blind person had only touched a fan before this. You know, the hugest thing he's ever touched was a fan. And he made the comparison in his head, and he came to that conclusion. Can we say that that experience, that respected, visually impaired individual went through was wrong? No. It was a personal experience that he went through with all his capacities, with all his facilities that he had been equipped with. And he deduced a conclusion from those prefaces. And we've all done that in our lives. Was the conclusion he reached wrong? Yes and no. No, in the sense of, well, an elephant does not look like a fan. I can't imagine any part of an elephant that resembles a fan. Well, maybe the ears. Oh, yeah, the big flappy ears, right? They resemble the thingies of the fan, the plates of the fan. But that's the last thing people who can see fans and who can see elephants would think of, you know, to compare elephants with anything. And also, no, he wasn't wrong, because that was his thought process. That was really the experience he went through that led him to this conclusion. Can anyone tell him that no, a fan doesn't? The fan that you felt is not like that? That's how he felt it. Can anyone tell him that no, the elephant you touch is not like that? That's how he touched it. So on one hand, he was right. The part of the elephant he touched really resembles the part of the fan he touched. And on the other hand, he was wrong. Sweetheart, elephants and fans have nothing in common. What's the point here, you might be wondering? Well, the point is, we do that so often in our lives, and we need to be aware that as much certainty I can have regarding my conception, my perception of a certain matter, because my own experiences, knowledge, and logic, and mindset has led me to that conclusion, and to me, it's totally correct beyond a shadow of a doubt, other people might feel like that toward their opinions as well. That doesn't necessarily mean all my opinions are entirely wrong or all other people's opinions are entirely wrong, but that definitely means we should keep an open mind regarding other people's opinions and our opinions and the possibility that maybe it's not as foolproof as I thought it was. Maybe I don't have all the facts right. Maybe the data I've received through my perception and my experiences are, in fact, flawed. That might come as a revelation to a lot of us, but it's the true fact of life. Sometimes I talk to my niece about things, and I tell her a rule, and her current catchphrase is, but that don't make no sense. Right? if I were a few generations older, I would probably throw a sandal at her and tell her, how dare you talk back at me and say what I said does not make sense. But because I listened to TED Talk, I think to myself, she's right. It doesn't make any sense to her. Through her faculties, through her perception, through her limited understanding and experience of life, that does not make any sense. And as an adult, as a caretaker, as a guardian, it's my fault, it's my job to sit on the floor, eye level with her, and explain to her different possibilities that she never thought of. Introduce her to other matters, other factors, other information, and help her make sense of that. Thank you so very much for being with us on this episode of The Lantern. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
That was all for today. Thank you very much for joining us. Inshallah, we continue this topic on the next episode. Till then, may Allah bless all of you. Fi amanillah. Ana bi dhikrillahi tatma'innul
qulub. IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Africa Today.
African countries are deploying troops in Mozambique to combat terrorists in the country's gas-rich Cabo Delgado province, which has witnessed deadly attacks by Takfiri terrorists and rebels. Recent attacks forced global energy giants to stop activities in the region, while locals have borne the brunt of the violence. One of those affected gives an eyewitness account on what happened during an attack by terrorists. Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and a warm welcome to another edition of Africa Today, a program which gives you an incisive analysis on events taking place across Africa. Now, in the first segment of our program, we are focusing on the decision by several African countries to join in Mozambique's war on Takfiri terrorists. We are asking, what are the chances of success in this mission, and what's the French connection? In the second part of our program, we shall focus on the situation in Nigeria, where children have been forced out of school due to an upsurge in abductions, especially in the northern part of this West African country. A parent of one of the abducted children speaks here during a protest gathering.
We stand in one voice, we condemn what has happened, and we'll protest, we'll continue to protest until our children are brought back.
African forces join Mozambique's war on terror. Since 2017, armed militants linked to Takfiri terrorist groups including Daesh have been on the offensive in the northern Mozambique energy-rich province of Cabo Delgado. The human toll of this violence is grave, with more than 3,000 killed, nearly a million displaced, and an acute hunger crisis. With several thousand fighters, the Daesh-affiliated Al-Shabaab in Mozambique has conducted increasingly sophisticated military operations, including by reportedly working with intelligence cells within the Mozambican military. Regional bloc, the Southern African Development Community, also known as SADC, and Rwanda are following up on committed troop deployments and training missions. Speaking during a SADC summit in April this year, Botswana's president, Mokgweetsi Masisi, said the region cannot remain indifferent to the insecurity in Mozambique.
We cannot stay indifferent as our fellow compatriots in a SADC member state continue to wallow under the atrocious, brutal, and indiscriminate assaults meted out on them by these faceless terrorists. For these attacks are a clear affront to the SADC vision of a region that is peaceful, stable, secure, and prosperous.
The Southern African Development Community held an extraordinary summit on June the 23rd and approved the deployment of what is known as the SADC Standby Force in support of Mozambique to combat terrorism in Cabo Delgado. Now, the bloc's executive secretary elaborates here at the end of the one-day summit in Mozambique's capital, Maputo.
Seven summit endorsed the recommendations of the report of the chairperson of the Organ on Quality, Defense and Security Cooperation and approved the mandate for the SADC Standby Force mission to the Republic of Mozambique to be deployed in support of Mozambique to combat terrorism and the acts of violent extremism in Cabo Delgado.
Now, for more analysis on the situation in Mozambique and the deployment of regional forces to combat terrorists, we have contacted Dr. Yusuf Adam, a Mozambican historian and academic. Thanks a lot, sir, for your time. Now, first, can you tell us some of the reasons for the current insurgency in Mozambique, which has been going on for several years now?
These areas of Cabo Delgado, etc., are areas which have been have a big problem with youth. They have a youth bulge. The second problem we have to mention is corruption. Corruption is rampant in Mozambique. The problem which we also have to take into consideration is environmental destruction. And the other problem is that the companies which are going to exploit petrol inland and onshore and inland, they have limited certain areas, and these areas are off limits for the local fishermen.
Well, clearly from what Dr. Adam has just said, the insurgency in Cabo Delgado is partly due to grievances by local people who are suffering from neglect by the government and exploitation by global energy giants in the region.
In Cabo Delgado, thousands of people are being forced from their land to make way for gas exploration by Western fossil fuel giants Shell, Eni, ExxonMobil, Total and others. Instead of locals benefiting from their immense natural resources, they are seeing poverty, conflict, debt, and pollution. What prompted regional African countries to make the drastic decision to send troops to Mozambique years after insurgents started their attacks?
At this moment, the war has been increasing, yes. The Mashababus they had attacked Mocimboa, but then they attacked Palma. And at the moment they attacked Palma, mainly means that they have stopped or they have obliged the French company Total to stop its activities and many other companies which worked for Total. And at that time also there was very big coverage in the press internationally about what was going on in the region.
Rwanda, which is not a member of the Southern African Development Community, was the first African country to deploy troops in Mozambique. Now, sources say SADC was concerned about a non-member country deploying soldiers in the region without its approval and ahead of the bloc's own troops.
Mozambique insists that while it remains committed to working with SADC to restore peace to the northern region, it can partner with other African states to address its security challenges. There have been reports that Rwanda is sending troops to Mozambique to protect massive economic interests of France. However, Rwanda's military spokesman says the deployment follows a request by Maputo.
The purpose of this mission, first of all, is based on a request by the government of Mozambique to the government of Rwanda to help support in conducting military operations, including the security operations, and stabilization as well as security sector reform. So this was a request by the government of Mozambique to the government of Rwanda, and this is part of a bilateral agreement that we had since 2018.
Rwanda is the only African country outside the SADC bloc to deploy troops in Mozambique. Rwanda's decision came after Emmanuel Macron's visit to Kigali. Now, is Rwanda probably acting on behalf of France to protect French energy giants engaged in Mozambique LPG projects?
I think that the Rwandese at this moment are some kind of private army. They are all Tutsis. It's a private army. It's a private army which belongs to a state, which is Rwanda, and they are attacking. They are in Mozambique. They came first, and till now there are the information which we have about their activities are more or less part of the propaganda that they have. I think that basically the Rwandese are going to stay around the Afungi and create an area of 25 miles of radius, more or less, around the Afungi, which was the area and the conditions that Total had asked the Mozambican government.
SADC deployment of troops and equipment to Mozambique has been welcomed by many local and international observers. Southern African states had been under pressure to mobilize and help the Mozambican forces to restore security and ensure civilian protection against attacks in Cabo Delgado.
Now, the main argument in favor of a regional intervention is the risk of a violent spillover into Mozambique's neighboring states. However, regional troops face many challenges, chief among them financial resources to fund the troops and experience in battling insurgents. Now, do you think regional forces will eventually restore stability in the restive Cabo Delgado province?
Yes, inshallah. I hope we will manage. And what we have to do at this moment is to combat the root causes of this war, which is having more girls in schools, so we don't have this youth bulge. We have to have the proper participatory development where the population feels that what they need is given back to them: water, sanitation, health, roads, infrastructure, etc. Job creation at a massive scale, so the young people can really feel the benefits of the development.
Well, there you have it. Our guest says the solution to the insurgency in Mozambique is to ensure that the people benefit from the country's resources. But will the insatiable greed by the mainly French energy giants allow the people of Cabo Delgado to benefit from the wealth of this region? Now let's take a short break. And when we come back, we shall focus on school children in Nigeria and how they have been affected by insecurity.
children affected by Nigeria's insecurity.
Since December last year, more than 1,000 Nigerian students and staff have been abducted and held for ransom by criminal gangs and terrorists in the dense forests of the northern part of this West African country. Now, humanitarian agencies warn that an alarming rise in abductions is disrupting education of hundreds of thousands of Nigerian children.
Since the infamous kidnapping of 276 girls from a school in Chibok, Borno State in 2014 by the Takfiri terrorist group Boko Haram, school attacks and kidnappings have steadily increased. And in the last 6 months, incidences have risen sharply. The United Nations Children's Agency, UNICEF, estimates that around 1,125 schools are closed across northwest Nigeria. Peter Hawkins, the UNICEF representative in Nigeria, elaborates on the situation of education in Nigeria.
The situation in education in Nigeria is probably at its biggest crisis point at the moment. There are in the region of 13.2 million children out of school in total, which is the highest number globally.
Some northern states of Nigeria like Zamfara, Katsina, Borno, Kaduna and Niger have been especially vulnerable to these school kidnappings due to a proliferation of these armed criminal gangs and terrorists. A student who was kidnapped and later released speaks here on what the kidnappers say is their motive.
They say, we are not after you, we are after the government. We now asked them, what did the government do to you? They said, government promised them and they failed it. What did the government promise? They now tell us that the government promised during the election, as in the election, the political rally, they promised them to give them good hospital, good shelter, good school, and those that are not working, they promised them to be giving them monthly allowance.
Now, for more on the state of the kidnappings of students in Nigeria and how this has affected education in the country, we have contacted Edward Corrigan, an international human rights lawyer. Thanks a lot for your time, sir. Now, our first question, how serious is the problem of children failing to go to school in parts of Nigeria due to insecurity?
The problem is very serious. There's over 1,000 children have been kidnapped. There was an incident in 2014, I believe, where over nearly 300 female students were kidnapped. And just recently, 140 boys were kidnapped from the Bethel Baptist High School. So it's very serious. In fact, a number of the five or six states in northeastern Nigeria have actually shut down all the schools to try to prevent these students from being kidnapped and held for ransom. And of course, the government is refusing to pay ransom, even though in the end, I think it has happened.
Thanks for that insight, Mr. Corrigan.
Organized crime syndicates have adopted a kidnap and ransom tactic, and this has forced state officials to negotiate with criminals and pay them millions of dollars in ransom to secure freedom for many school children. The government has rejected claims of paying ransom. After years of terrorist attacks, kidnapping of school children is a recent phenomenon in Nigeria. Why have the kidnappings escalated?
Part of the problem is that there are criminal groups and bandits that are kidnapping children and holding them for ransom, for money. So you have this additional factor plus the Boko Haram and also another group called the Islamic State for West Africa Province. It's ISWAP, but they have split off from Boko Haram and they're actually now the dominant group because they just actually killed the leader of Boko Haram, who is a little bit of a crazy man, Abu Bakr Sadaku, who supposedly was killed at the orders of the Islamic State in the Middle East. But you have criminal groups.